Hello, and welcome back to the Album Files podcast. My name is Abby Mickey. We're here to talk about music and stuff. Emphasis on the stuff. I'm joined by Matt Deneve.
Hello, I'm here.
Thank God. And Ian Treloar.
Yep, I'm here to a similar degree.
Fantastic. Ian was our pick for this episode, and we're going to talk about Bon Iver in a little bit. Let's just ease into the podcast today. You guys got any good listenings lately?
I can start by disappointing everybody, or at least the two of you, by saying that I haven't been listening to all that much over the last couple of weeks. But I have listened to parts of Jacob Collier's new album, Jesse Volume 4, which is out now. I'm disappointed I haven't had time to listen to the full thing, but his cover of Bridge Over Troubled Water from the album, of course, a Simon and Garfunkel song, the cover is spectacular. It features John Legend and Tori Kelly, and it's an a cappella arrangement reminiscent of the early stuff that Jacob Collier used to do on his YouTube channel back in the day, and stuff that he's won a Grammy for, I'm pretty sure, is a cappella arrangements. It's just a stunning arrangement, and as he has done with a bunch of his tracks over the years, he's done a full breakdown of how he recorded the session. So YouTube video of him showing his Logic file with all the several thousand different audio files in it and how he's recorded it. And it's like an hour and a half long breakdown of this 5.5 minute track or whatever. So if you love nerding out about how brilliant musicians make brilliant music, I'd highly recommend that. And I'm really looking forward to diving into this album because it's been years in the making. 3 or 4 years now, I think, and a big part of the album is all these voices that he recorded from concerts that he did around the world, and those kind of audience choir videos that he's posted online in the years since have been remarkable. So, yeah, really looking forward to diving into that more, and sad I haven't got to yet.
I like the track with Brandi Carlile, and I think that was released quite some time ago, like when I saw the album come out and I hit that one. It's something I definitely have listened to it before, but I really love that song.
Yeah, there's a few tracks off the album that have been released in various forms over the last few months or even years, actually. Probably 4 or 5, if I had to guess. There's definitely some cool stuff on there, and I imagine it's probably going to be quite overwrought in a lot of places, like a lot of his stuff is, but still brilliant, and some moments of just absolute brilliance in there. So, yeah, looking forward to diving in. What about you guys? What have you been listening to?
I can share with the class.
Oh, you've been to live music.
I've been to live music. It's a weird little frenzy of live music. I think 4 gigs in a week and a half.
Whoa.
Which is just insane for somebody that doesn't normally leave the house. So, I saw the National on Tuesday. Little spontaneous ticket that I was hooked up with by my friend and listener, friend of the podcast, Laura. So I went and saw the National, and I was kind of on the fence about going to see the National at this point in their career because I haven't really loved their last couple of albums. But great news, they mostly focused on the old stuff. So huge win.
If you could just refer to them by their full and proper name, which is the Sad Dads of the National, that'd be great.
They had this amazing merch. They had a t-shirt which said Sad Dads on the back. So it was just people walking around in a Sad Dads t-shirt.
Perfect.
And you didn't buy
I was tempted.
For you and Matt.
I thought it'd be overkill. And then tomorrow night I'm seeing a Rouge Aftab, which I'm looking forward to. And next weekend, I think I'm seeing Wilco, which is not a band that I've spent very much time with at all. And on Sunday, Tim Hecker is in Melbourne, which I'm excited about, playing some sort of, I don't know, power plant in the western suburbs. that's the live music that I've seen or will be seeing before the next episode. There's also a new Alcest single and a new album on its way in June or July, I think. And it's really good. Really, really like it. And because I've been trying to get into a work vibe, I've just been absolutely hammering the blank mass like I normally do when I'm, you know, trying to focus. So those two albums, 150 times, not the whole album, but tracks, their tracks, 150 times in the last week. So that's good.
And has it worked? Have you got into Abigail. A good have you got into a good work vibe?
What with blank mass? Intermittently. I need to be tactical with it, because if I overuse the stimulant that is their music, then I worry that its effect will reduce. So yeah. Need to target it.
Did you listen to Sofiane Pamar?
No, I forgot.
The French composer?
I'm excited to listen to it. I was excited to listen to it then. Yeah, no, it needs to get on there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it'll be quite as stimulating, but it's good. It's good stuff. I've listened to a couple of his older albums in the last couple of weeks that are also as like quite good. That I enjoyed. I've not really been listening to much music at all, to be honest. I have been reading too much in my free time to listen to music, and so it's been a musicless couple weeks besides this album. But I am really excited for the new Bleachers album tomorrow. I feel like their last album that they released in 2021, 22, I don't remember. But their last album that they released, the singles that they released from that album were like incredible. Like the one with Bruce Springsteen and Chinatown with Bruce Springsteen. And then there was one other that was really good. And then the album itself, I didn't love. So I'm excited for this one, and I hope it's not the same, because I feel like the singles that they release, especially Tiny Moves, I think is one of them, and Modern Girl, I really like those two songs. And so I'm wary that we're going to have the same situation, but I'm also excited. I'm excited for the album.
I'm excited too. I had forgotten that it was coming, and now I've remembered. So something to listen to. Thank you.
Do we want to talk about For Emma Forever Ago?
I suppose we probably should. Why not? Anyone that listened to our last episode will know that this absolutely snuck up on me. I had forgotten that I needed to choose an album. And this is the one that in an absolute panic, I chose. And I have been kind of beating myself up over it intermittently over the last, probably the first week of the last 2 week block. But I've come around. I think that it was actually a genius move, and I'm quite proud of myself now for spontaneously inflicting this on people. So that's good. So with all of those caveats in place, the regret and the remorse and then the triumph of punching through all of those things, let's talk about For Emma Forever Ago by Bon Iver. This is Bon Iver's debut album. At the time, the band was not a band. It was a solo project from a guy called Justin Vernon, who's a beardy man from Wisconsin. He'd had a pretty rough trot over a number of years before this album came out in 2007 or 2008, depending on which version of it we're talking about, and recorded this record as a way of grappling with it all. Vernon was a longtime musician. He started out in music while still at high school with a band called Mount Vernon before releasing three little known, little circulated, basically just, self-pressed solo albums through the early 2000s. In 2001, he had a new band as well called Diamond Edison with a bunch of friends from Wisconsin. Diamond Edison recorded a couple of albums and made a minor impression in the blogosphere of the time. Their music was a kind of mix of folk with some sort of Americana kind of twang, and it was fronted by Vernon. He mostly sang on their albums in this rich lower register at the time that is a bit uncharacteristic when you hear his more common falsetto today. The band moved to North Carolina for a stretch. This is Diarmid Edison, not Bon Iver, for a stretch. And then they broke up in 2006 in bad terms. At that time, Justin Vernon was 25. He was suffering through a period of pretty bad ill health, including a bout of pneumonia, and then he became severely ill with a type of mononucleosis or glandular fever that gave him an infected liver. As the cherry on top of that shit sandwich, he broke up with his girlfriend at the time and was nursing a broken heart, and he was also grappling with regrets from the collapse of an earlier relationship and his sort of lost love. So he was, in this moment, kind of unmoored from North Carolina, where he was living, and facing a series of personal challenges, and returned to Eau Claire in Wisconsin, which is his hometown, still is, and then went to his family's hunting lodge about an hour away from there, which is set on 80 acres in the wilderness in the middle of Wisconsin winter, which is cold and snowy and dark. So for 3 weeks, he sat there alone, chopping wood, watching TV and drinking, and then he decided to do something more profound with his time. Brought in his guitar from the car, it was in the back of the car after he'd moved from North Carolina, and then just drove straight through, and some bare-bone recording equipment, and started working on song ideas, developing his falsetto and multi-tracking vocals into harmonies, and then building up these songs, he says, quote, for 14 hours a day. Until he started to feel a little insane. There was pretty limited interaction with anyone else, apart from his dad, who'd stop by every 10 days with delivery. Justin shot a couple of deer and traded venison for repairs to a guitar at one point. So that's a big outing to the Big Smoke. But yeah, pretty stripped back existence. The writing process for this album began with the music first, and then Vernon would record these wordless vocal lines over the top, slowly building on lyrics through a process where he'd record the melody, then record random syllables over that, then go back and listen to them a bunch of times, he said 20 times, and write down each time what he thought he heard of his made-up syllables, until it was all compiled into this final version of the songs, which explains why the lyrics are often quite abstract, but with occasionally intelligible snatches that sort of stick in your head, a sort of representative lyric is, only love is all maroon, lapping lakes like leery loons, leaving rope burns, reddish ruse. So I think that there's definitely some really abstract imagery, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on, and how the lyrics work or don't towards the effect of the album. But it's interesting, and that's how it was created. At the end of this 3-month block throughout the winter of recording in solitude, he invited some friends around for an evening, had a few whiskies, and then recorded the brass lines and I think the pedal steel, the bits that he didn't play himself on the album, and then the album was done. He's since spoken of his feeling of this time in the woods as something that has been almost mythologized in a response to the album and in the backstory of the band. Quote, he says, it's sort of odd to look back and see it as magical because it felt like a lonely few months at the cabin where I plugged in the laptop and fucked around. For Emma, Forever Ago was initially supposed to just be a demo, but he was persuaded to do an initial run of 500 physical CDs, which he sent a handful of to media. So those self-pressed, self-released ones are ridiculously expensive now. The outlets that found out about the record, though, were really stoked on it, and it spread quickly via blogs and word of mouth. By October 2007, he had a really positive review in Pitchfork, gave it an 8.1, I think, or something like that. And then the album continued to spread through 2008. After all of that initial burst of hype, he'd signed with this big indie label, Jag Jaguar, which is part of the secretly Canadian group, which has a lot of artists that you've heard of, including Phoebe Bridgers. So in 2008, although it came out in 2007, it ended up on a bunch of year-end best-of lists. Came number 29 on Pitchfork's top 200 records of the 2000s. Was the album of the year for a couple of different British publications. Did pretty well. This isn't my favourite Bon Iver record. That would be the self-titled follow-up from 2011. But I do think it's an interesting one to discuss, even though I came at it spur of the moment, because it's got this really rich mythology around it. And for something with such a intimate and sort of small beginning, it has gone on to have such a substantial impact on the music world. Over the years since, Bon Iver has gone on to collaborate with a who's who of indie rock and beyond. A particularly prominent appearance was his vocal features on songs on Kanye West's Mega Smash My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, which is I saw your sneer there, Abby. Agree, but good album. Bad person, good album.
There are albums that Kanye West have made that would be just amazing for this podcast.
That's one of them, I reckon. Yeah. So he was on that album. He was also on the follow-up Yeezus. He was on Watch the Throne, which is a collaborative album between Kanye and Jay-Z. And more recently, he's collaborated with Taylor Swift, was in a band with, or still is in a band called Big Red Machine with Aaron Dessner from The National.
Oh, shoot.
Has collaborated with...
I'm not wearing my shirt. I have a
you are wearing a shirt.
I know, but I'm not wearing my Big Red Machine shirt.
Ah, oh, dang it. Oh, it's right there. Ah, oh, this is good. I should prepare. I should prepare clothing for pulling out at points during the episode. Who else? He's also collaborated with Zach Bryan, St. Vincent. Yeah, lots of really big names and lots of people that are in a similar circle with lots of people that we've spoken about before. Bon Iver is not a solo project anymore. It's now a six-person band, four albums into their career. They work fairly slowly, but you know, every 3 years or so they come out with an album. They've won a Grammy for Best Alternative Album with the self-titled follow-up to this album. But at this point, this really hushed and introspective record has been certified platinum in the US for over 1 million copies sold or stream equivalents, shifted over 100,000 vinyls. And I think its legacy is that it's kind of established a new singer-songwriter type, trope, I don't know, for the decade and a half since, with the sort of disappearing into the woods and emerging with a broken male record of melancholy. So that is enough talking from me about this record for now. Who'd like to say something?
I can jump in. Thanks for the intro, Ian. Always insightful, always detailed. Lots to chew on there for sure. I've kind of had very minimal exposure to Bon Iver. He was kind of one of those guys for me that was on the periphery for a long time. Like, I knew about his stuff, I knew about the band stuff, I knew about Justin Vernon, but hadn't really heard much of the Bon Iver work. And I'd obviously heard Skinny Love from back in the day when this album came out, and Ree Stax as well. I'd heard that. I didn't realize I had until I listened to it again for this podcast, but I'd heard that one as well. And obviously I'd heard his work on Exile from Folklore, as you talked about before. But I think this is the first time I'd heard a Bon Iver album in full. And I kind of hinted at it last week when you made the decision to put this one in front of us, but I was aware of the story of this album, and it really resonates with me, that whole shutting yourself off from the world, giving yourself over entirely to the creative process and just having time and space to create. And I know that, you know, you shared that great quote about him kind of dispelling the mythology around it a little bit and how it wasn't actually as magical a time as people might think. But having had smaller amounts of time like that myself, I do know how positive it can be. And whenever I think about the story behind this album or read more about it, it gets me really excited and inspired to do more stuff like it. So I think from the outset, before even listening to anything from this, I was already engaged with this concept and really excited to see what it would create. And I mean, it's just a beautiful piece of work, really. I think that's the kind of overarching thing for me. It's melancholy but beautiful, and I think that combination is, you know, we've talked about it many times before, but that combination just works so well. I think, you know, a theme running throughout a lot of our episodes is talking about the opening track and how that sets the tone or doesn't set the tone for the album. And I think Flume really does here. It gives that real, you know, rough acoustic guitars, the multi-layered falsetto vocals that you talked about. There's that, yeah, the beautiful melancholy vibe. I think it really lets you know from the very start what you're in for, and what you're in for is, you know, about 37 minutes of just beautiful lo-fi in a way, honest, kind of heartbreaking music. The thing that really stood out to me and that I most wanted to talk about was just the roughness of this album. And I'm glad you pointed out in that it was meant to be a demo initially, because I really hear that when I listen to this. And there's the perfectionist part of me listens to this and finds it a bit uncomfortable in parts. Like, there is definitely part of me that wishes he spent a bit longer tuning his guitars or recording tracks that actually were in time. Yeah, there's like in Blindsided, the kick is out of time a lot of it, and you know, there are vocal takes that are out of time with one another, and the horns are a bit out of time in For Emma as well, and stuff like that bugs me. And I know that says more about me than it does about the music, and there's a part of me that's able to just push that aside. And I think you could probably say that the roughness of the recording is a feature rather than a bug. And I think, you know, if you're more eloquent, I'm sure you could do this, Ian, but I think you could probably draw some parallels between the way it's recorded and crafted and Justin's mental and physical state at the time, I guess. You know, he's kind of in a rough place, and so the recording that comes out is kind of rough as well, and it's got an honesty and an organic kind of roughness to it, which I think is kind of endearing as well in a way, even if it does grate on me at points.
I think it also places it in the location. Like, it doesn't sound like it's recorded in a studio. It sounds like it's recorded where it is, in a creaky old sort of cabin in the woods. And those bits of not just the way it's recorded, but the way the recording sounds, the fact that you can hear at times like creaks and things moving around, and at the end of Restacks there's like 30 seconds of just the sound of the room. And I think that helps build this sense of this as being a record from a particular place in a particular time, in a way that straight, you know, recording studio take would not.
For sure. I definitely agree with that. There's part of me that goes, you could do that and you could keep the sound of the room and you could keep the kind of badly recorded, like the low quality audio, but you could also just tune your guitar and you could also just re-record the kick drum so that it's in time. Like, as little things like that, where it's like, you could still maintain the essence of it, I think, without, you know, and also just make it a bit more pleasing to the ear. But I suspect I'm probably not alone on that, but I suspect that I'm in the minority there, and that's my perfectionist coming out. And that's me listening to it as somebody who, if I'd created that, would be listening to it going, okay, I need to fix that. And in some ways, it's kind of like, it's to be applauded, the just going with the fact that, you know, it was supposed to be a demo, but just being like, well, this is actually good enough and this is representative of what I did at the time, and so I'm going to put it out. And that's, to me, that feels like quite a freeing thing to be able to do. And I don't know what he's like in terms of those perfectionist tendencies, but yeah, that definitely comes across to me, is those things stand out. But I think that's really a minor point. And overall, I really, really enjoyed this. It's just a beautiful album. And again, the resonance, the kind of context of how it's recorded and where it was recorded, and, you know, the snow outside and hunting for deer and being locked away and confronting your own physical and mental challenges, like all of that manifesting itself in this beautiful piece of art is incredibly resonant for me. And I'm really glad that you put this in front of us, Ian. And I was going to ask whether you, because, you know, you said last week that you regretted the decision, and I was hoping that over the course of the 2 weeks you would come to realize that it's actually a really good choice. And I really think it is. I think it's a beautiful album, and I'm really glad that you chose it.
Yeah, I think it's a good one to talk about. I think I would, if I was to choose differently, I would choose something that I was more excited to listen to, because I've listened to this a lot over the years. And I like it, but, you know, I would be more excited to pop the next Bon Iver album on repeat, for instance. Like, I think that there would be more there to enjoy, but I think that this is a good one to discuss.
Just the final thing I wanted to say before I throw it over to Abby. The one point about the kind of roughness and the organic nature of it, one thing that really stands out about that to me is in The Wolves, there's a moment where you can hear kind of flickerings of the auto-tune that he uses. And that really stood out to me as, like, nothing wrong with auto-tune at all. I'm no problems with people using that at all. But just the idea of, like, on one hand, you got this beautiful, raw, organic, rough album, and then you've also got these kind of licks of auto-tune in the background. It's kind of feels like a bit jarring to me, the juxtaposition of those two elements. But again, maybe I'm nitpicking, maybe that says more about me than it does about the actual album itself, but I thought that was worth highlighting anyway.
I think it's funny, Matt, listening to you talk about the editing of it and the perfectionism, your perfectionist tendencies, because that's exactly why I love you editing my written work, because you always pick up on the little things that are out of tune, but you're also super complimentary of it. The little things don't impact your view of the work as a whole. And so just a observation.
I love that. Thank you. It's very sweet.
I also really love this album, and I also am really glad that Ian picked it, because I feel like a lot of the times we pick albums and we talk a lot about the music and the artists that made it, and we've yet to have an album that we could really dive into the process that the album was made. And I think for this one, it's an album that you really need to think about how the album was made when listening to it. And I think that you get a better experience out of listening to the album and consuming the album if you know the process of which it was made, or that it wasn't made in a studio. So yeah, I feel like it's a really great pick. And for me, like, I've talked before about how I am a lyrics first listener, and this one really challenged me because, well, for one, I can't understand what he's saying 98% of the time. But also it's all just nonsense. beautiful nonsense, but nonsense. And so I liked listening to it and kind of putting myself out of my comfort zone and listening to it. And I think for his vocals in particular and how the music works together, his vocals are really like an additional instrument to the music that is so far removed from the actual words that he's saying. And I found that really cool. Like, it's beautiful, his vocals. But I mean, even if it doesn't make any sense. So I think even if you can't actually listen to the words, it still adds a lot to the music. And so I found that really interesting. And I think there's a reason that Skinny Love was the song that really kind of went above and beyond this album as a whole. Like, I was listening to it this morning and my sister said, "Oh, that song is iconic." And I think it's because it's probably the only song on the album with very clear words that you can parse out. And so it's been covered by everyone and their mother because it's like such a beautiful song and the whole album is just stunning, but that's the only song that can really like you can cover because there's actual substance in the lyrics. So I just found that really interesting. But as a whole, I feel like there was very little that I didn't like about it. I definitely feel like it, I want to listen to it outside, which I feel like is so, when you know, like that it was recorded in the woods, then that answers any questions you might have internally about why you are so compelled to listen to it in the woods. Like I wish I was in Latvia listening to this in the forests because I feel like it would just fit.
Yeah. On the lyric stuff that really resonates with me. I had this thought as I was listening to it. I think it was tonight before we started recording that I had basically no idea what any of the lyrics were. You know, apart from Skinny Love, like you mentioned, Abby, but that didn't really bother me at all, or it didn't strike me as unusual because there are a lot of things that I listen to for this podcast and generally where I have no idea what the lyrics are, because as we've talked about a bunch of times, it's so minor in terms of the actual enjoyment of the thing. And it made me realize that actually, yeah, his vocals are really hard to understand, particularly in that falsetto register. And it's beautiful. It's amazing. Like you say, it's stunning. But I was curious when I had that realization for myself, what that would mean for you guys. Because I know for both of you, you're more lyrics focused than I am. So it's interesting to hear that you still enjoyed it, even though you weren't able to latch onto as much stuff, Abby, as you normally would. How did you find that aspect of it, Ian? I mean, I know you've got a long history with this album, but was that a factor for you as well?
You know, I don't really think it ever has been so much with Bon Iver, which is kind of strange, but the voice is kind of an instrument, a texture, more than it is a means of conveying a specific message using words. But I think a message is still conveyed. I think that there's still emotion and you can feel the gist behind it or what the intent is, because it has that sort of heartfelt delivery a lot of the time. So I think, I mean, there are times where I feel a little bit like Bon Iver's music keeps the listener at somewhat of an arm's length because it is so abstract lyrically, or uses like sometimes quite arcane kind of language, or just the construction of it is kind of oldie worldy, and it's interesting. But I think that there's still an emotional sort of accessibility to it, which is pleasant. A funny story on the lyric front is that one of the songs from the next album was played at our wedding, and my brother-in-law was playing keyboards and singing the vocals, and was like, he speaks English, but he's Norwegian. He's like, what does this mean? And I'm like, don't know, buddy. Like, it's those are the lyrics that you've got from somewhere, but I don't really have a clue what he's trying to say there.
It's interesting to me on Skinny Love how, you know, we've talked about how that is more accessible in terms of being able to hear the lyrics. It's also, if you listen to listen to the album in track order, it's the third track on the album. It's also the first time on the album that you hear him flip out of that falsetto register down into a lower register. And it's quite striking being the first time that you hear that. I mean, sort of different if you know the song already, but when you listen to it in context, the first time you hear him drop out of falsetto, and it's, I just found it really effective. And then he uses that same register when he's belting the chorus later on, which is a texture that you don't hear much, if at all, on the rest of the album, I think. which makes it stand out as well, I think, as a standout song on the album for sure. And like you said, Abby, I think it makes a lot of sense that that was the one that was chosen as the single for it.
It's interesting for me listening to this album because I don't know, I've resisted Bon Iver in the past, ex-boyfriend. I cut that out of the last episode, but yeah. So I've kind of, like, he used to play Bon Iver a lot and I would kind of just ignore it. And so I've not really ever gone and listened to him or them by choice. But after he was on Exile on Folklore, I was like, I loved it. And also, I mean, especially in the version on the Long Pond Studio Sessions, he's just amazing. But I wasn't ready for what he did vocally on this album because I'm so used to how he sang on Exile, which is like so different from this.
So low.
Yeah.
I do like his lower register. I think it's really, really rich and beautiful. But yeah, it is definitely a switch from the falsetto, which is, yeah, he's probably better known for from Bon Iver.
I think that just makes it more effective, doesn't it? When he does use the lower register on this album, and I don't know what his other albums are like or their other albums are like, but yeah, here when he flips out of the falsetto, it's very effective as a change up, I think.
The other albums, just if you are interested, get increasingly less accessible. So
in what way?
The one after this, I think, is probably the pick of the bunch. But then from that point, there's a lot more sort of studio trickery and glitchy stuff, and it's all kind of chopped up and, again, a little bit more removed. So that's the kind of arc.
Does it get heavier at all? Do they get a heavier sound? Because there was a moment...
Yeah, on the next album.
Right. Because there's a moment on The Wolves when they start... When it starts... Part two of that, when it starts to get heavier around 2:45, it builds beautifully and you get kind of like a noisy outro or whatever, but there's definitely a moment there where I wanted some heavier drums and some louder guitars to kind of really take it to the next level, and it felt like it was just lacking a little bit, and it made me wonder if that was a direction he or they explored in later work.
Yeah, I think that the self-titled album, the one after this, I mean, we're also talking about a time where it's gone from a one-person sort of recorded at home project to a 6 or 8-person band at that time, with like a bass saxophonist and a really, really proficient drummer. So, yeah, I mean, there's heaps of points on the next album where they are just belting it, which is pretty cool.
Great. I should check that out then.
It's kind of funny like how... for such a long time, I just thought his name was Bon Iver and that was the guy. Cool name. But like, yeah, I you have no idea that it's more than one person. And also that there's a real name attached to it.
Yep. I'm with you. I really appreciate
it. Do you have more to say?
Yeah. I was just going to add that it's just a small thing, but I really appreciate that this is a shorter album as well. And maybe that's reflective of my limited attention span these days, but less than 40 minutes, 9 tracks. It's great. Doesn't need to be any longer than that. Comes in, does what it needs to.
Get in, get out.
Yeah, that's great. Again, probably says more about me than it does about anything else. But how long is
gonna be? 48 minutes.
It's an episode of Lost.
48 minutes?
We really need to be doing like sitcom length albums. Just churn through a 20-minute one.
We've had a couple, haven't we? We had Godspeed.
Yeah. We've had some and really quick ones. The Griff one was...
Griff, yep. Less than half an hour as well. I'm looking at my list of albums to recommend for next episode, and the runtime of them is definitely a factor. Like, I don't want to throw a super long one in front of you guys. Also, don't want to throw it in front of myself, so... Yeah.
It's just a lot of homework, isn't it?
It is.
As far as favorite songs on the album, I don't know if we want to talk about it. or mention it.
No, I'd like to talk about it. I think that
Matt already mentioned how great the intro song was, setting the tone for the whole album, and I agree. Like, I feel like it carried through the album beautifully. I feel like for me there are songs that I loved a lot more, so it's interesting. Usually the title track, if they've done a good job of selecting the title track, it always falls into my favorite songs on the album, but for this one I really enjoy it, but I didn't love it as much as some of the other songs. Like, I really like Lump Sum, Skinny Love, Creature, Fear, and also Restacks is really good. And I think that it, as an outro song, it does like such a good job to close it out. In my opinion.
It's a stunner. That guitar riff that starts with that runs throughout the whole thing is pretty special. And the fact that it's just stripped back to vocal and guitar is really quite nice as well. Not that I don't enjoy it when there's a bit more going on, but it might be the best song in the album for me, I think, the way that it ends. Yeah, it's a banger. I, as we've talked about in the past, I put asterisks next to each track ones that I particularly like when I'm writing up my notes. I've got asterisks next to 6 of the 9 tracks here, so that's a pretty good sign. Flume, Skinny Love, The Wolves, Blindsided, For Emma, and Restacks. And the other 3 are just fine. There's not a bad song on here, not even close. I just liked 6 of them more. It's just incredibly solid. Like I said, I would have liked something a bit heavier in The Wolves, I think. I felt like it slightly missed opportunity there. And I think you could argue that Restacks could be a little bit shorter, possibly. But, yeah, still very, very solid.
I've got asterisks next to Lump Sum, The Wolves, Blindsided, and Restacks. The 2 songs that I don't really connect with on this album are Skinny Love and For Emma. I think that they're the most sort of straight up and down verse, chorus, verse kind of, they're the least interesting songs to me because they are the most conventional.
Is part of that because you've probably heard Skinny Love about a bajillion times since it was released?
I think that's possibly just sort of overexposure, but I also think that when I first listened to the album, which would have probably been 2007. Back then, I don't think I would have had a different opinion either. I remember then being completely floored by Restacks, Lump Sum. And yeah, I think that it's probably not a thing that's changed that much since. 8.3. From me.
I think an 8 for me.
I think 8.3 is a great rating. I'm going to go with that as well.
I was trying to look up what the runtime will be for Tortured Poets Department, but it's not out yet. But
it'll be like 75 minutes. It's going to be
16 songs plus the 4 bonus tracks.
Ugh, it's just too much. Too much.
No, it's not. There's no such thing as too much Taylor Swift. Come on.
16 tracks. Ugh.
Then don't listen to it, Matt.
Just as some extra context, midway through this recording, Abby just put on a Taylor Swift jumper.
It's a good jumper, too.
It's her red era.
Yeah. It's great. You've done very well.
Also the one that was sitting there. It was just the one that was sitting there.
Do you just have a pile of band merch that's just ready to go during these recordings? You're just like, oh, I need to get it all out. So that I can change outfits mid through.
I like that thought process. Unfortunately, I did pull out the Big Red Machine purely for this album shirt. And then I realized that the reason that I forgot to put it on is because I've wrapped it around my daughter's sound machine so that the light from the back of it isn't, you can't see it in the night. And that's why it's there.
When you get off the sound machine, you'll just experience this moment of blissful quiet. You're just like, oh my God, I have been listening to noise for the last 2 years, and then it stopped, and it's quiet. It's so good.
What is this thing? I'm not familiar.
I think like a white.
It's like
noise
a white
machine.
Noise machine.
Oh, white noise machine. Right. Sorry.
Yeah. It helped. Does Luca use a white noise machine?
Yeah, he did earlier on. Like, yeah, a while ago. But it was only in his room, so he never really heard it. So.
Well, Lila sleeps with me, so when Tom says that raises.
It's a gateway drug, though, because you've got the sound machine and then you just need to ramp it up to harder stuff. And then you've just got a vacuum cleaner running in the bedroom. Watch out.
Or you're 33 years old and the best way to fall asleep is still listening to Jim Dale read Harry Potter on 0.8 speed.
So specific.
It's me. I mean, it's slow enough that you get bored listening to what he's actually saying, but his voice is just so lovely.
You're a wizard, Harry.
Oh, God. Sounds like a nightmare.
Matt, what album are we doing next?
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it?
Are you just going to pick the... I figured you would just pick the Jacob Collier album.
No, I think that's too risky. Plus, it's really long. Oh, so.
Thank goodness. Thank you.
No,
I was about to hand in my resignation.
I'll do Mars Volta instead, Ian. Got him. I've got a long list here that I could choose from, and I don't know. It's such a vibes-based decision, isn't it? Could go a bunch of different ways. I might have regrets about this one, but I'm going to do it anyway because I think there's a lot to talk about, and I know at least you, Ian, will be interested to talk about this one. So let's go back to 1998. Any guesses, Ian? You've got a thoughtful look on your face. Do you wanna guess?
1998.
It's a second and final album from a short-lived group.
Oh, I was thinking it was going to be like Powderfinger or something.
No.
What country are they from?
I actually don't know. Probably the US, maybe Canada. Anyway, I'll just tell you. The album we'll listen to for next episode is In the Aeroplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel. Which has some stuff to talk about. Is an interesting one. So, Ian, you probably know this album, or you do know this album better than I do, so I'll be looking forward to your contribution as well, but yeah, it's a fascinating one, so.
I'm very excited. That is one that I haven't listened to for quite a while, and I just go through these periods where I'm like, I really should listen to that.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy that I have this opportunity.
Yeah.
Do you know this one, Abby?
I have never heard of this band or this album before, ever.
You'd probably call it a cult classic, wouldn't you, Ian? Or it's
I think it not even cult like it's one of the I'm struggling to think of a more important indie rock record in the last 20 years. It's
there you go.
Exciting.
That sets the scene nicely.
It was a lot of overstatement then because I just remembered like Radiohead exists and there are many other bands. But yeah, okay. Cult classic. We'll go with that.
And also this album was out 26 years ago. So yeah. Not 20 years, but that's fine.
Oh, well.
But apart from that, you did great.
No, I'm just being fact checked in real time.
Yeah, it's fun for everyone. Yeah, so In the Aeroplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel.
Awesome. All right, well, we'll listen to it and get back to you guys in 2 weeks. Thumbs up. Double thumbs up from Ian. Awkward. And Matt.
We did it. We did it again.
It's always a miracle.